Hi, this is Dwight Gingrich, and you are listening to Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Session 1 of 6. This is a recording of a blog series that has the same title. The blog version includes links to Bible verses and online sources, as well as many footnotes with added comments and documentation to source my quotes and support my claims. I invite you to visit my website if you want to dig deeper into what you hear here, or if you want to leave a comment for me or for other readers. Simply go to www.dwightgingrich.com and search for the series title, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? There are 6 sessions in this series. Session 1, Introduction, Explanations, and a Summary of this series. Session 2, How Should We Interpret Jesus' Silence About Homosexuality? Session 3, Does Love Your Neighbor Mean Jesus Affirmed Gay Love? Session 4, Why It's Wrong to Say Jesus Said Nothing About Homosexuality? Session 5, Historical Conclusions, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? And finally, Session 6, Conclusions for Today, Is Jesus Okay with Homosexuality Now? Thank you for your interest in this topic. Let's begin. I have never discussed homosexuality on this blog. I've decided it's time to change this. So, after some reading and conversations to prepare, I've drafted a 6-part blog series on Jesus and homosexuality. Since this is a difficult topic, please bear with me as I share a long preamble in this first post. It doesn't really matter what I believe. What matters is what Jesus believes. Yet perhaps, if I explain myself a little first, I can clear the ground for discussing what really matters. There are many reasons not to write about homosexuality. The topic is a linguistic and political minefield, full of labels and terminology that are constantly evolving in meaning and correctness. It's intrinsically complex, involving questions such as causation, nature versus nurture, etc., public policy, and church discipleship. It's a sure way to win some enemies while also winning friends whose responses you can't always fully endorse. I've also heard it suggested that this is a topic best left for private conversations, face-to-face interactions with people whose trust you have already earned through friendship. I agree that those kinds of interactions offer possibilities that mere blogging does not. My greatest fear in sharing this series is that my medicine, though urgently needed by some readers, will prove to be a painful overdose for others, readers who are already convinced of the truth of what I share and who need help knowing how to live with these truths. If that describes you, please forgive me for not being able to give personalized medical care according to each reader's need. I hope you can still sense love in my words. Why I am writing. Despite these reservations, I've noticed something that has convinced me it is time to write. I've noticed that many who are promoting homosexual behaviors do not have a similar reluctance about expressing their views in public. I'm noticing that both social media and traditional media are filled with statements justifying and celebrating homosexual behavior. The closet has long been abandoned for the megaphone. In fact, most North Americans probably hear far more public comments promoting homosexual behaviors than questioning them. I know I do. When one hears a new idea often enough, it often becomes easy to believe, especially if it is simply and winsomely defended while opposing views are ignored or caricatured. As the years pass, I'm seeing more and more friends and acquaintances abandon what they once believed about homosexuality. Some are now practicing homosexuals. Others are celebrating their choices. For many people today, contrary to the experience of most people throughout most of history, it now appears much more logical and loving to approve of homosexual relationships than to disapprove of them. In our culture, at least temporarily, the arguments in favor of homosexuality appear to be winning the day. I know a few blog posts are unlikely to make much difference, and I feel poorly equipped for the task. But somebody needs to do it, so I'll try. What I am writing about. To keep my job easier, I'll narrow my focus. Narrowing my focus is essential unless I want to write a book, but it also brings dangers. Having a narrow focus means I'll pass over many crucial pastoral questions that deserve clear and compassionate thought. For example, I think I'm gay. What should I do about it? My friend is LGBTQ+. How should I relate to them? Is gay Christian a helpful label? What about the terms homosexual and heterosexual? I am using the former term homosexuality in this blog series as a catch-all term to describe all forms of LGBTQ+ behavior, not because I unquestioningly accept the paradigm, but in order to avoid verbal mouthfuls. Another example of a pastoral question, how can we support those who experience persistent desires they did not choose, and which they have repeatedly and unsuccessfully asked God to remove? Is it possible to change one's sexual orientation, or good to try? How, if at all, should Christians try to shape social policy about sexuality and gender identity? How can we love someone well while disagreeing with them about something as fundamental as sexual morality? And we could mention many more pastoral questions. I will also fail to meaningfully discuss several crucial questions of biblical interpretation, such as, how should Christians interpret and apply the Old Testament, including its commands against homosexuality? What did Paul mean by the specific words he used in the passages where he mentions same-sex behavior? Please hear me. By skipping such questions, I do not at all mean to imply that they are unimportant. Rather, I mean to focus my energy where I feel best equipped to contribute. If you want a broader pastoral approach, I'll recommend one resource right up front here. Look for the article online called The Powerful Witness of Same-Sex Attracted Christians, written by Emily Hallock. My goal in these blog posts is to examine a single question, one that is more foundational than most listed above. My question is, was Jesus okay with homosexuality? I am intentionally phrasing the question in past tense, because I intend to focus on historical evidence, considering what Jesus of Nazareth, the person who lived in the first century rather than the Jesus of today, what he actually believed. I'm not making this distinction because I believe that there are two different Jesuses. However, I want us to push past our fuzzy feelings about Jesus today to consider actual historical evidence. It is easy to say, I think Jesus believes X, if we pull him and one or two of his sayings or his silence out of his first century context into our own. But if we consider his actual historical context, our possibilities are more constrained. In considering Jesus' historical context, I will use both the Bible and other ancient writings, treating them essentially alike as historical documents. I believe the Bible is more than a collection of historical documents, but it is certainly not less. I will address some theological questions along the way, and especially in my final post, Conclusions for Today, Is Jesus Okay with Homosexuality Now? But my focus in this series, my goal, is to focus on historical evidence and, where I make theological deductions and pastoral applications, to keep them tied closely to that historical evidence. Who I am writing for and what I hope to accomplish. I am aiming for a specific audience as I write. As my blog purpose statement says, this website exists to build up the Church of Jesus Christ by helping her listen carefully to the Scriptures. This means I am writing primarily to people who identify as Christians. For such readers, I am aiming to shore up your biblical beliefs about homosexuality, or, if you have already lost them, to invite you to reconsider the evidence. I also have my children in mind, hoping they will read this or similar material someday. Other readers are welcome to listen in, but please realize I will not be trying to answer all your questions. Please hear me. I am certainly not writing to attack my homosexual friends. You probably did not choose your desires any more than I chose mine. I've heard too many stories of people becoming aware of homosexual desires from childhood to believe that all such desire can be explained by personal choice or by external factors such as abuse. I ache for the many who desperately long to escape homosexual desires, but with no success. I ache for those who turn to the church for compassion and support, but find only ridicule and rejection. Please hear me also in this. I do not believe that the mere experience of homosexual desire makes us guilty before God. I say that, even though I do believe that such desires are disordered, or to use a more ancient term, contrary to nature and God's initial good creation design, I believe we all live in a broken world and that we experience its brokenness in unpredictable and seemingly unfair ways. Some of us are disordered in other ways, leaving us more prone to things such as anger, anxiety, depression, or experiencing deception. I do not believe we are guilty merely for possessing such tendencies, any more than I am guilty for having been born with a susceptibility to the shoulder injury I experienced. Rather, we are accountable for whether we feed and act on our disordered desires, or whether we submit them to God. And even then, whatever your life choices, one of my life mantras applies to you as surely as to me. We all need more love than we deserve. I desire to offer you dignity and love, even, especially, when we disagree. After all, disagreement too is a form of love, for only what is true can ultimately be pastoral. When my title asks, "Was Jesus okay with homosexuality?" I am primarily asking about behaviors, not desires. I do believe Jesus held beliefs about homosexual desire similar to what I sketched above, that the experience of mere desire, weakness, hunger, or temptation, is neither intrinsically sinful nor something to be celebrated as being in line with God's original good creation design. Yet I also believe that God places people with many varied weaknesses in Christ's church and intends to use such realities for good. My title, therefore, refers primarily to the question of whether Jesus affirmed homosexual behaviors. My main goal in writing these posts is to convince readers that agreeing with the historical Jesus and affirming homosexual behavior are not compatible. I believe it is intellectually inconsistent and also disastrous to the Church of Jesus to try to combine the two. If you want to affirm homosexual behavior and yet remain Christian, then the onus is on you to do some theological footwork to explain why you can believe differently than the historical Jesus and still remain Christian. Most Christians by far disagree with you, and so do most secular gay scholars. I think you need to choose between the two, and I sincerely hope you choose Jesus. Enough about me. Now that I've told you where I'm going, let's jump right in. Here is a summary of what I plan to say in the series. Following is the sort of argument we sometimes hear from those seeking to undermine Christian opposition to homosexual behavior. It is simple, and it is attractive. 1. Jesus never mentioned homosexuality, much less spoke against it. 2. He said love is the greatest commandment. 3. He befriended social outcasts, including those who were called sinners by the religious elites. 4. Therefore, Jesus was and is okay with loving homosexual relationships. The first three points are, on face value, all true. But what do they mean? And does point 4 logically flow from points 1, 2, and 3? The first three points, that Jesus never mentioned homosexuality, that he said love is the greatest commandment, and that he befriended social outcasts, these three points need to be read in light of their historical and literary context, or else they will be misunderstood. I believe that all three, or at least the first two, are true only with asterisks. And even if we accept them at face value, point 4 is not proven by points 1, 2, and 3. Here is a summary of my response to such thinking, a summary of the series to come. 1. All known Jewish teachers for about 2,000 years who addressed homosexual behavior agreed that it is very sinful. So Jesus had no more reason to address the topic than to address a topic like bestiality. If he, as a Jewish rabbi, had disagreed with this consensus, he would have been immediately rejected. His silence on the topic would have been assumed to be agreement, and should be assumed so by us, unless there is very strong evidence to the contrary. 2. Jesus' command to love your neighbor as yourself was a quote from the Old Testament book that also contains its strongest teachings against homosexual activity. Ancient Jews and Christians saw no conflict between promoting love and opposing homosexual behavior. Jesus taught that loving God is the most important commandment, and that loving your neighbor is second to loving God. Thus, loving your neighbor, according to Jesus, involves treating your neighbor in a way that pleases God. Jesus' teachings on love do not indicate he was okay with homosexual activity. 3. Though Jesus was a friend of sinners, he called them to repent. He also affirmed and even strengthened core Jewish sexual ethics. He spoke against sexual immorality using language that was normally understood by ancient Jews to include homosexual behavior, and his followers spoke explicitly against homosexual activity. 4. Therefore, no churches anywhere, until a few in the past decades, have ever taught that Jesus was and is okay with homosexual relationships. My responses are not as pithy and memorable as the arguments they oppose. Truth involves complexity, but I have tried to summarize these key points briefly, since short arguments are more easily remembered and remembered arguments are more convincing. Really, it is startling to even have to make these arguments. The historical evidence about what Jesus believed about homosexuality is so overwhelming that it wasn't seriously questioned by any church denomination until the early 1970s, about the time I was born. But if my responses here are too brief for you, fear not. I plan to discuss these points and more in the next posts, providing historical evidence for my claims. Meanwhile, thank you for listening to Session 1 of Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Session 2 jumps right into the historical evidence, addressing the question, how should we interpret Jesus' silence about homosexuality? I invite you to continue listening or to visit www.dwightgingrich.com to leave a comment or review what you just heard. This material is copyright 2019 by Dwight Gingrich, but you have my permission to share it if you do so freely and give proper credit. Thanks again for listening. And God bless your day.